105 FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Mubaraka Ibrahim, and this is Mornings with Mubaraka, where we talk about national issues from a local level through a lens of diversity. You're listening live on 103.5 FM on your radio dial in New Haven, Connecticut. And you're also listening on newhavenindependent.org. Or maybe you're on New Haven Independent Facebook page or the Fit Muslima Facebook page. Either way, you are listening to our live show today. Good morning and happy Wednesday. I am your Wednesday morning voice, Mubaraka Ibrahim. And today, we are talking about Black wealth. What is it? Why we don't have none? And how do we get it? When we talk about wealth in the Black community, it's no secret that there's an economic gap. We know that there's a history of economic and structural racism in America. But I believe that knowledge is power, and indeed power today is wealth. So today we're talking about how we get economic wealth in the Black community. And what can we do in our personal power that not just gets us out of poverty, but also break the generational poverty, break the handing down poverty. There's a saying that says white people die and leave wills and Black people die and leave bills. And there is some truth to that. According to Matt Brewing of Demos.org in his article, the top 10% of white families own almost everything. He states, white families hold 90% of the nation's wealth. Hispanic families hold 2.3% of the nation's wealth. And Black families hold 2.6% of the nation's wealth. So to dive a little bit deeper into this conversation, we have with us economic strategist Anna Blanding. Thank you for joining me, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So let me, Anna is the founder and principal of Pilliner Group. Did I pronounce that right?
The Pilliner Group.
Pilliner. I've been going back and forth on how to pronounce that for like hours. Anna is the founder and principal of Pilliner Group, a firm providing investment services to foundations and endowments and growth strategies for businesses. Prior to this, Anna worked as a senior investment associate at Choate Rosemary Hall, working across all public and private asset classes to manage the boarding school's endowment. Previously, Anna was an investment associate at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, a $4 billion endowment where she focused on the foundation's venture capital, private equity, private credit, and real estate portfolio, as well as the social impact portfolio. She has an undergraduate and business degree from Yale University. She has lived in the greater New Haven area for almost 20 years and is passionate about community economic development and helping families create wealth for the next generation. She is actively involved in several nonprofits and sits on the boards of Capital for Change, a community development financial institution, and the National Angelman Syndrome Foundation, a passion dear to her heart. Thank you for joining me, Anna, and I am excited about this conversation.
Well, I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and I think it's a great time to talk about Black wealth. We're in January. It's cold, but it's the beginning of the new year, and I think it's a great time to really kind of take stock of your financial health, what you can do for this coming year, and really just thinking broadly about not just, you know, about how to create wealth, which is very different than income.
Absolutely, because that was actually my first mm-hmm. question. And I think that this question has been on people's mind, particularly since the election, right? Mm-hmm. When the news talks about kind of like Trump is not really, he's not as rich as he say because he doesn't have liquid assets. So what is the difference between, what is wealth? Like, what do we categorize as wealth? Somebody may say, I'm rich. I just got my income tax, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Right. That's a whole lot different than actually having wealth. So right. Like, break that down for us.
Sure. So income is what you are, you know, what you're actually bringing in. So let's say you work and you make $100,000 a year. That'd be your income. Mm-hmm. But however, if you're spending $100,000 a year, your actual wealth would be zero if you're spending mm-hmm. $150,000 a year. So wealth really is looking at calculating all of your assets. So let's say you might look at your investments, your home, value, anything that's assets, you know, and you also, then you deduct all of your debt. So that may be your mortgage debt. It might be your car debt. It might be your, you have credit card debt or student loan debt and whatever that number is. So let's say if you took it all what you have and you deduct what you owe, that really is going to be like your net worth. So you could be a person that makes $500,000 a year in income, but if let's say you have, you know, a $1 million mortgage, and let's say you have a lot of credit card bills and you're maxed out here, there, you have a lot of student loan debt, then you basically have negative wealth. And I think also this idea of generational wealth, you know,
I think that is really, and that's a really interesting point to drive home, because in a way I don't think that a lot of people understand that concept, mm-hmm. right? So we push this idea of making sure, even among the circle of people who yeah. talk about creating generational wealth, we say, okay, buy a property, own a property, but you can own a property and still have no wealth. Well, because when we're talking, so we're talking on two hands, what you actually own as far as asset, mm-hmm. as well as what your debt is. And that right. is where a big problem comes.
That's the big problem. Right. Yeah. Right. That's the big problem. And I think even when we're talking about, you know, with black, so let's, you know, just kind of breaking down this wealth. And so, if you look at the disparity, you know, there's an income disparity, obviously, between black and white families, but there's even more important, there's a wealth disparity between black and white families. And so, you know, in America, you know, you have this 1 in 7 white families have a net worth of $1 million. That's 15% of wow. white families. This is data from, I think last year, end of 2016 data. Wow. So if you have, you know, 100, you know, 7 people white, one of those, 1 out of 7 would have a net worth of $1 million.
And so we're talking, so let's clarify that. Net worth, which means the amount of money that they have minus the amount of debt that they have, what they have left over.
Right.
So we're not just talking about they live in $1 million homes. Right. We're talking about, okay, they may live in $1 million homes, but they actually have more money than what that home is worth.
Right. So let's say, so if you live in $1 million home and it's fully paid off, that means that you have a worth of $1 million. Mm-hmm. You have $1 million home, but you have a worth of $900,000 on that home. Mm-hmm. That means you only have a wealth or equity of $100,000.
And then if you got $100,000 worth of debt, then now you're zero.
Right. Right. And there's many. And then obviously with the recession, there were people that you had a $250,000 mortgage, but yet your home was only worth $150,000, you know, mm-hmm. home prices were falling. So you actually have, you know, you don't even have equity in that home. Mm-hmm. And so I think this idea that, you know, this is, you know, this idea that, you know, 1 in 7 white families have, you know, a net worth of $1 million, whereas 2% of black families have a net worth of $1 million. If you look on average, the average white household has about $171,000, like their net worth. Mm-hmm. The average black household is about $5,000. So mm-hmm. it's about, you know, it's a huge disparity. And your wealth, you talk about, you said, you know, white people die and leave wills, black people die and leave bills. You know, the amount of wealth you have, that impacts, you know, what you're able to transfer to your children while they're living. If you're able to pay maybe for their college outright versus mm-hmm. having to take loans, mm-hmm. it obviously impacts what you're able to transfer at, you know, at death. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of white families, they do receive, I think 25% of white families receive an inheritance, mm-hmm. And a pretty substantial amount of inheritance, whereas the average black family, I think it's only maybe about 2% of black families that receive an inheritance, and the actual number is much lower. So, you know, there's a lot of points along the lifespan where wealth is transferred. Mm-hmm. You know, let's say you go to college. If Anna goes to college, to Yale, and has to take out $100,000 loan versus another person is able to have, you know, is her parents pay for Yale, then we're starting off, maybe starting off at 22 years old, maybe even making the same income, but yet I'm paying a big student loan bill. She's yep. not. Yep. And I think even sometimes at marriage, I have a lot of friends, their parents might gift them with a home or a substantial mm-hmm. down payment for a home, mm-hmm. versus a black family might be, you know, struggling to buy that home. Mm. And then obviously, so, you know, so wealth is really, you know, the more, you know, having wealth means you're able to transfer it to your mm. children. And it means that they're, you know, it's like starting a race where we're both running, but maybe you're 50 feet ahead of me at the beginning of the race. And so it's really hard to
catch. And that's really interesting that you mention that, because I think that's another milestone in life that we don't think about wealth creation, right? When a couple is just starting mm-hmm. off and now they are trying to, you know, start the next generation, being gifted a property versus, you know, now we're like, oh, look, what a great accomplishment. We brought a $250,000 home. You just got yourself in $250,000 worth of debt.
Right.
Whereas someone who was passed that home from a parent or grandparent, they're already starting off without $250,000 worth of debt.
Right.
So that is actually a really, really good point. And that maybe that's another show. Should we be buying homes and getting into debt?
Right. I definitely, you know, I'm a homeowner. I definitely believe, but I think that's, and so when we look at, even if you kind of break down black wealth and white wealth. And so over the years, you know, say the past, the stock market has really been on a tear lately. You know, there's been, so, you know, I think it's at, I forgot what it is, 27,000. So it's very, you know, it's very high. So, you know, there's been a lot of wealth accumulation that's happened. Even after, let's say the recession happened in 2008, 2009, you know, we're in 2017. Now, there's been a lot of wealth accumulation that's happened. And, you know, black families have, for the most part, stayed kind of, either have dipped or kind of stayed kind of static, whereas a lot of the wealth accumulation is going to people who are in the, you know, in the stock market, who their property values have increased. So in that, and even that is an example where there's been historic policies where, let's say, if a black family buys a home, they're most likely buying in a neighborhood where the property values are not going up that much because of redlining and things like that, where they were not really able to get in affluent home, affluent neighborhoods.
Right.
So I think even with that, the idea that even when you own a home, you know, some people, some families' home values are going up tremendously. Some families' home values are either staying very stagnant or decreasing.
And is that a contributing factor to what we hear of this this shrinking middle class, about how even in the economic boom, rich people are getting richer and poor people are getting poorer, and middle class is getting poorer.
Right.
And that's a part of that.
Yes, it is. It is, because, you know, really a lot of the wealth that's been created over the past, you know, just a history of wealth of creation. It really is accrued to people that are, you know, it's basically accrued to people who are in, you know, who are investing in business ownership. And if you look at the way our tax plan in America is set up, it's really structured for business owners, for investments. That's why, you know, capital gains taxes are taxed at less, a much lower rate than taxes you earn from being an employee. So even things like that, just our whole system is set up really where wealth, you know, accrues to people that are the elite class of, you know, I mean, it was in the 1700s landowners, but it's the same thing now. It's people that own businesses, you know, are investors. And so if you basically are living paycheck to paycheck, then you're probably not going to have that discretionary income to put in the stock market, that where you can really experience that compound interest and start making really good strides in wealth accumulation. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Mornings with Mubaraka, and I am your host, Mubaraka, on 103.5 FM in New Haven, Connecticut, streaming live on newhavenindependent.org and going live on Facebook Fit Muslima page. And today we are talking about black wealth with economic strategist Anna Blanding. You can help us spread our voice by sharing our live Facebook video, participating in the conversation in the comments. Y'all know Facebook got like these new analytics things, so y'all gotta say something. Like, don't just watch, say something. And sharing our SoundCloud archives of this show that can be found on fitmuslima.com. Anna, so we know that there's this disparity. Let's talk about what we need to be doing at each stage for black families. Mm-hmm. At what age, like, we don't want to stress our kids out. Mm-hmm. Like, they're five and like, oh, you will never go to college because your mom and dad is broke. So right. When do we start teaching them about economics and about money?
Right. So I'm giving my strong personal bias here. I think that you start very early, because one of the differences between a lot of black families, I wouldn't say black, but I'll say lower income families and higher income families. That may or may not be translated to race. But one of the differences is that a lot of families don't talk about money. It's a very kind of, it's like something that's done in the dark. You don't really talk to your children about money. A lot of people have a lot of kind of anxiety around money. and how to handle it. They are intimidated by, you know, even something like investing. They're intimidated. How do I start investing? So a lot of
People just, they only talk to their kids about money when they don't have it.
Right.
And you have this because I don't have money like that. We can't do this because we don't have money like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So So for a lot of Black families, you know, like I said, if you've had generational poverty, a lot of times even the word money it evokes a lot of stress. It's not something that's pleasurable or relaxing. It's stressful about what you don't have and the scarcity mentality. Maybe you saw your mom try to, you know, pay bills and maybe the lights got cut. So it's a very kind of, it invokes a lot of anxiety. So I think this idea, so a lot of children don't really have this working understanding of, you know, of money, of the financial system, of delayed gratification, of saving. So I would say you start very early. We have two children. Daniel is 6. Our daughter is 3. And we started by giving him an allowance. And so he's really young, but he lost a tooth. And so we basically, you know, gave him $6 for losing a tooth, which I think is too high of a going rate for losing a tooth. But but the point was that we get to give him 6 single dollar bills. And we talked about, you know, you're going to put a dollar is probably going to go to like church or, you know, a charity. You know, you're going to make sure you save $2. You can spend, you know, $2. And, you know, beginning to think about that idea of saving, of spending, of, you know, helping, you know, of giving back. And so I think from a very early age, you know, starting children, I think pretty young, starting them, you know, by giving them an allowance. Okay, let's say if you do a certain amount of chores, you get this amount of money. And not so much for the money per se, but just so you can start interacting with money. And it's a very normal thing. Mm-hmm. And I think being able to, you know, I have a friend, a good friend of mine, who I worked with at Choate. And his son was, I think, 7 or 8 at the time. And he actually bought his son a stock portfolio. Him and his son sat down and it was, you know, they thought about companies that the son liked. I think it was Disney and maybe Lego, things that, you know, children knew about. And I think Apple, and they bought a basket of stocks and they were able, you know, his son picked out the stocks. They monitored the stocks. They, you know, they saw their portfolio did. And so I was amazed. I said, that's really amazing that at 7, this little boy, you know, knows about investing and what you're looking for in a company. It's, you know, you keep it very basic, but this idea. So when he's 20, it won't be a foreign concept to him. It's something you do, you invest. And so I think that, one thing we can do as Black families is really begin to make sure that talking about money is a very normal thing that our kids, they go with you to the bank. They know what a bank looks like. They see you writing out a check or things like that.
So what is every economist has a different philosophy about this. So what is your philosophy about kids actually seeing you use credit cards versus using cash? Does it make a difference on how they view money?
That's a very interesting question. I really believe that cash, like I said, I like to give our son cash. I really think there's a different tactile sensation you have. You see it better. Okay. I give you a dollar. I think credit cards, the swiping is a little, it's hard to process. And I said this before, I have a little child now and we go to Target and he really does not realize you have to actually pay for something. Either you can just like, oh, if you want, you just take it off the shelf. He doesn't realize you have to actually exchange something for it. And so I think he thinks like, oh, Target is just our like a big, you know, playroom. Right. Like, no, you have to actually pay for something. That. And so we're actually, so right now he wants that little, I think it's a Lego toy. We're actually working towards this Lego toy. But I think that, you know, obviously credit cards, you know, we're probably going more into a cashless society, but I do think that there's something to be said for still, you know, kids seeing cash
at that age.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's easier to process, you know, a dime, a quarter, a dollar than it is to think about a credit. I think it's a little too esoteric for them at that age to understand, you know, credit cards. And I think even for us, a lot of us with credit cards, that's why we get in trouble with credit cards because we really just swipe and we don't realize that, okay, that means I now owe Visa $100. You know, we think like, oh, I'm just swiping. I got that dress. We don't realize, okay, now I then have $100 probably plus interest, you know, whatever that is, 10%, 12%, 27% obligation now to Visa.
Yes.
And if I don't pay it off at the end of the month, I have even going to, so maybe that $100 dress I bought, I might end up paying like $450 for it at the end of the, the dress has fallen by the wayside, got dirty by the time I paid it off.
Don't fit no more.
Right.
And I'm still paying for it.
Right.
That was, I think that one of the lessons that I learned the hard way that I definitely passed on to my kids is, you know, when I got in college, all the credit card companies sends you credit cards. I had like 10 credit cards.
Right. You had a free frisbee or something.
You had like 10. I had Victoria's Secret everything, right? Shoes, clothes, because they sent me a credit card.
Right.
And when my kids got in college, they are sending you credit cards. Do not apply for them.
Right.
I would have to say, I would like put away those little mail things from the credit
right,
card
that's
companies.
Smart.
And I constantly would remind them, this is how they're going to get you when you get in college. Don't apply for the credit cards. So let's talk a little bit about the teenage years. And this was the hardest for me. So, you know that I have four children. Mm-hmm. They're all, the youngest is 17 now. They're between 17 and 24. And that teenage years, I think, was the hardest for me in thinking and teaching them economics. Number one, they think they know everything.
Right.
That's a problem. Number two, they don't have impulse
right.
control when it comes, and they want.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that we need to be teaching them in those teen years about wealth and economics that can help them in the future?
So yeah, I think this, what you probably can teach in the teen years is really about this idea, you mentioned it, this, you know, really making sure you instill this concept of delayed gratification, you know, of being, to know that, you know, have goals, you know, if it might be, I want to save $1,000 this summer for my books or whatever, you know, they have them start thinking about their future. Like they say if they're 17, that means they're probably gonna be in college the next, you know, year or whatever. I think even earlier, let's say, you know, maybe 13, 14, really make sure they're thinking about, you know, their future. So you can even, you know, so one thing is that saying that, you know, your grades are really important, because obviously if you maybe have great grades, you can get scholarships to college, which means that you can then have someone else pay for that, or a chunk of that you don't have to pay for that. So I think, you know, a lot of times kids like, okay, got to, you know, why make good grades? But the reality is good grades will save you money in the long,
you know, it's
in the
funny,
long term.
You know how kids don't listen to you until after the fact. My daughter, who is 19 now, she said to us a few weeks ago that she now understands the concept as we were telling them when they were young, grades is money. That
right.
there, it's literal dollars, because she has a friend who got full scholarships to three colleges.
Mm-hmm.
She got a full scholarship to, and so she had her pick and choose to
right.
choose which college she
right.
wanted to go to, because they always given her a full ride.
Right.
And she was like, I understand now that she was like, because this is a kid that's been on honor roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's done well
mm-hmm.
throughout her whole school career. And so now it's literally turning into dollar bills. And if you're talking about places like, you know, Yale giving mm-hmm. you a full scholarship, you're talking $250,000,
yes. $300,000
right. of money.
Right.
Because you did your homework.
Right. Right. yes. Following the teacher's order, you know,
exactly.
her, you know, homework instruction for the night or whatever. Yeah. And I think also, and one thing I think is very important for the teen years, and particularly around with Black families, in college is very important. I went to college. College is very important. But I think we sometimes place such an emphasis on college. And then getting a good job. And I think we have to really think about, you know, teaching our teens about, you know, this idea of entrepreneurship, you know, this idea that, okay, you can go, yes, you definitely go to school, but thinking about how you can not just be an employee, but how you can be an employer of people.
Absolutely.
And employ people and be a business generator in your community. Because the reality is that the work structure has changed. That, you know, my mom worked at a company for, you know, from the time she was, I think, out of college all the way till she retired, and she got a great watch and she had a, you know, a pension and things like that. That model is really changing, you know, that about your company will take care of you. And so I think one thing to teach teenagers is this idea of, do you have ideas? You know, think about them doing business. It might be something as simple, I'm going to shovel snow, you know, I'm going to be a snow shoveling business. I'm going to hire people or I'm going to babysit or, you know, really think in this idea. Or, you know, I was reading this article yesterday on Forbes magazine, I think it was this article titled 30 Under 30. And it was basically about these young, you know, kind of teenagers and young 20s that were doing had amazing businesses. You know, there's a little girl who I think she started selling, what's it called? Lemonade. And, you know,
yes.
I love that.
It's
a little Black girl who she had, you know, she started selling lemonade. I think she had like honey from her grandmother's farm or something like that.
Mm.
And she's now in Whole Foods. And this girl is doing, you know, having a Whole Foods, you know, lemonade throughout the country.
And you know what else I love about her story? And I've been following her for a minute. What I think is really interesting, because she not only goes to the spirit of entrepreneurship, but also respecting young people's idea and lifting them up to do what they
yes.
want to do. One of the issues that came up around her was she was invited to a college to speak, and she was paid $10,000, and people were complaining, why does an 11-year-old need $10,000? And the president of the college said, if we had invited anyone else who was a successful entrepreneur who was an adult, we would have paid them $10,000.
Right.
Her qualifications requires $10,000. We can't not give her that because of her age.
Right.
And I thought that that was such a good lesson for people as far as respecting, because normally, not normally, but a lot of times people don't take kids seriously, right?
Right.
Like, oh, yeah, that's gonna little idea that's gonna fade.
Right.
But we have some really serious entrepreneurs among our young people. And I think the other thing that is really important is that we differentiate between creating community wealth mm-hmm. through creating businesses mm-hmm. versus side hustles,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So a business, when we say, do you have a business? Most people will be like, yeah, well, I sell, I'll use something that's out of fashion so I don't get torn apart on
right.
the internet. I sell Mary Kay, right? Yeah, I got it. And it's selling an MLM is really not a business.
Mm-hmm.
A business, if we want to increase those statistics, is a company that employs at least one person other than the owner.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are concerned about community development, Black economics, building community wealth, mm-hmm. then our goal in whatever type of hustle you may
right.
have now should be to employ one person. But that puts a lot of pressure on you because that means you got to make some real money.
Right. Right.
So that takes entrepreneurship to a whole nother level. But I completely agree with you. Entrepreneurship is so incredibly important. And we have, as a Black community, really left that by the wayside
right.
to our own detriment.
I do agree. This is one of the things, you know, I think that with the civil rights struggle and, you know, definitely the modern civil rights struggle of the 60s, where you was about integration, which is a tremendous thing. It's great that people are at Yale and things like that. But I think this idea that, you know, we believe that the goal is to be working for a great company
mm.
as opposed to thinking like, how can I go to Yale and then create a great company
right.
and use that knowledge I received from Yale to create a great company. And so this, I do agree with you that, you know, I think if you look at even just, I mean, in general that, you know, in the Black community, I think it might be 1 or 2% of people that are entrepreneurs. But before it was a significant, much more significant.
Some stats that I read was in the 1950s, somewhere near 73%
mm-hmm.
of
right.
Black people were actually entrepreneurs. Now we're at 1 or 2%. And that's a, you know, I think that what has happened, and it's just totally my own personal opinion, is that we have not reached high enough. Right. So mm-hmm. we have, and it was really interesting. And this is, I guess it's not really a side notice within the conversation. There was a recent article here in New Haven of the new Church Street South redevelopment, mm-hmm. that they're redeveloping it. And in the article, it spoke, and it wasn't the article, it was actually one of the comments that made me think mm-hmm. really hard. The article had a quote from a gentleman who stated that he had been living there for 50 years and he was born into those mm-hmm. projects and he had a huge opinion, which was very valid. And that wasn't what my thought process was about, that the fact that and for people who are not in New Haven, Church Street South is an low income housing project. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was one of the comments said, why has he been living there for 50 years? This is a low income housing and its goal is to give people a jump start. Mm. Like, why is he still there after 50 years? And I thought about that for a minute. I was like, yeah, that's kind of crazy, right? Because we have kind of like, I shouldn't say, there is this common mentality of, hey, you know what? I'm doing better than my parents because I'm a cook at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on welfare, right? Or I'm doing better than my parents because at least I'm living paycheck to paycheck mm-hmm. and I'm not on government assistance. But that's not really reaching high enough. That's not going to close, make a significant impact in closing that wealth gap. So how do we teach now young people who are going to college how to reach a little higher?
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's really important. You know, there's a lot of, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but there's a lot of, you know, studies and, you know, there's a lot of data that talks about, you know, kind of, you know, how important environment is and what's normal for you. So if welfare is normal, then you think, okay, if I'm not doing welfare, mm-hmm. then I'm above normal. I'm above average. So I think this, you know, we have to kind of, this is where I think the benefit of even, you know, the internet is this idea of exposure. And so making sure that we, you know, really thinking long and hard about who are we comparing ourselves to, you know, are we, mm-hmm. and so, you know, like I said, a lot of us have these, you know, you mentioned it, these views that, okay, as long as I maybe, you know, able to pay all my bills, that's great. We're not thinking about, the idea that I could pay my bills and have $1,000 left over every month, so being able to, and not going to invest it. So I think being able to really, really think about who we're comparing ourselves to and having goals. So this is a thing that, a lot of us kind of live very, have our financial lives being very passive. We don't really think about, setting some stretch goals for ourselves. Like, okay, this year I want to be the year that I, employ one person, or I want to be the year that I eliminate my credit card debt. I want to do it by December. And so this, like I said, this is a great time to be talking about this in January, but really kind of sitting back right now and assessing our financial, our financial health and our financial life, and really setting some goals, some stretch goals. And I think, this is where, but definitely like for young people, being exposed to other people. This is where I think mentorship is really, really important. People, being around people who may not have come from the same background as you, but can teach you different things. Because, you could always, like I said, I came from Oklahoma. Before coming to Yale, I never had even been to Connecticut before in my life. I was very much like a Oklahoma, born and raised person. And then coming to Connecticut, it was like, wow. So Yale was a very, it was a great experience for me, because I was able to see new parts of the, different type of people. I met people who, were the sons of, presidents and or presidents of Nigeria. And, you kind of see the whole different world and having different ideas for what your life can become. And that was very beneficial to be, for me, Wall Street was something that was very foreign to me. Whereas a lot of people at Yale, everybody, all their dads and their parents and their moms worked on Wall Street, was a very common thing for them. So I think this idea of, really thinking about who are you comparing yourself to, and really having it, realizing that whatever you were born into, that, it particularly, I think this is a great thing about America still in the world we live in, especially I think with the internet breaking down a lot of barriers, that you can, even if you're born into welfare, born into this, that, you can still kind of do better than what maybe a previous generation did. And I still fundamentally, believe that about our country. And I think, I said with the internet, I think with entrepreneurship, like the young lady who sells tea, I think, it's like you can use the internet a lot now to market yourself and things that you don't really have to buy. You don't really have to use so much money to get started. You don't have to get a marketing company to market. You can maybe put it on Facebook or do something. So there's a lot of opportunities out there.
Mm-hmm. So what is that? So when we have our young people who are now going to college and they're getting out of college, what are some of the first things that they need to be doing and thinking about their own wealth in order for them to break this this poverty?
Right. So the main thing, this is one of the big crises in America is student loan debt. I mean, that really is, as far as I think the main thing of when you get out of college, like I said, so when you're in college, try to take as the least amount of loans as possible. So let's say if you I remember being in college, you might take more than you need, but you said, I'm going to go shopping or do this, so don't take money to go shopping with you. Make sure your money is just for what you need to get, to get through school. And so I think really trying to make, and then, and having that be a really first, a first step for you to say, I'm going to get out of student loan debt as quickly as possible. So let's say, one thing you can do is when you get, let's say you graduate from college, your first job. So a friend of mine, a really good friend of mine always says, be the CEO of yourself. Like, make sure you're your own CEO. So really look at yourself. Even if you go to work for somebody, look at yourself like, I am a business, And I think, let's say you have your first job. One thing I would say is that, the offer they give you, negotiate. If they offer you $30,000, ask for $35,000. Ask for $36,000. Ask for $40,000. Really negotiate. I think a lot of times, a lot of young people are so happy to get a job, or even in definitely, I think even with women, we don't oftentimes ask what we think we're worth. So being able to, really think about yourself as, I'm the CEO of myself, and I want to think about how I can get out of debt as quickly as possible, how I can make as much as possible, how I can keep my expenses down as much as possible. So when you're in your 20s, I would say that the big ideas would be to, make sure you have financial goals. Do you want to buy a home? If so, when? If that's the case, if that means you might not be going out partying every night. You might be thinking about saving that money towards a down payment, or, maybe, going out with your friends. There's a lot of ways where you can spend a lot of money by little things. I went out to eat five times this week, and maybe you could have cooked and maybe saved that $50 and use that to something else.
So really thinking about saving at that age and being more frugal in their activities. And
yes, and being more frugal in their activities. But that's, I think, so definitely the thing about saving. But I think that also when you're young, I can't stress enough the importance of investing. you know, a lot of times we are hesitant to invest. And so I would say, so if you have a job, let's say you work for Yale, for example, you know, really making sure that you are maximizing everything that your employer is giving you. So if they're giving you a 5% match for, you know, retirement. So a lot of times when you're young, you think, oh, retirement, you know, I'm 22. I don't think about 65, but really, really from young, thinking about, you know, maxing out your retirement accounts, any kind of benefits that you offer by your employer, take advantage of that. You know, let's say if they offer you a flexible, you know, health account where you could maybe, you know, put pre-tax money in for your doctor's appointments, you know, use that. But really get in the stock market, because the reality is that, you know, like I said, a lot of you can't save enough, like you can't work hard enough to beat compound interest, like investing your money. And letting compound interest happen over time is one of the best ways to accumulate wealth. And so the earlier you start, you know, there's a lot of, either the story, not story, but you can say a person that invested $2,000 a month from age 20 to 30, or a year, I mean, or a month, or maybe a year, you know, that person investing $2,000 every single year from 20 to 30 and just let it sit, they would do better than the person that starts at 35 and does it every single year till they're 60. That's how magical compound interest is. And so I think that, you know, when you're young, get in the stock market. And the reality is, a lot of times people are very nervous about the stock market. They feel that, you know, you see crashes, you say, okay, well, if I put my money in, will it crash? Will I lose it? And there is a risk in the stock market. You know, there is cycles and things like that. But if you put a dollar in, even with all the crashes that we've had, a dollar in the stock market is still worth, well, you know, still worth a lot of money, even with right. economic 10, downturns 20, and things like that.
20 years down the road.
Yeah.
And that's a part of that delayed gratification, teaching them delayed gratification. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Mornings with Mubaraka on 103.5 FM, New Haven's home for community radio, streaming live on newhavenindependent.org and going live on Facebook Fit Muslima fan page. And today we're talking about Black wealth with economic strategist Anna Blanding. You can help us spread our voice by sharing our live Facebook video, participating in the conversation, comment, because Facebook got some new analytics, and share the SoundCloud archive of this show, which can be found on fitmuslima.com. So we're talking about investing. Investing is one, it was going to require a few things to get psychologically ready. We talked about that delayed gratification point. Why do you find that is investing is a better option to, say, buying property or just putting your money inside of a savings account or buying, you know, and investing in bonds? Like, where would you put that in a priority for someone who's really interested in building wealth?
So I think that there's, you know, all those strategies are good. So let's say, all those strategies are very important. And so really it's not an either or. I think, you know, so let's say, so investing, you really should be looking at the long term. So, you know, so let's say if you need money in a year to, let's say, buy, or let's say 6 months to pay your mortgage, don't invest that money. You know, that should be in a savings account.
Right.
But save in 6 months. So I think, you know, a savings account, what it is really, is it's a safe place. It's an insured place. It's a safe place to put your money. But it's not, you're not getting anything growth. You might get 0.2% or 0.1% from Bank of America or whatever, but it's not growing. And the reality is, so basically, if you have a dollar today, inflation is growing about 3 or 4% a year. Your interest rate of 0.25% a year, that means that the dollar today, what you can buy with a dollar today, you could not buy the same thing with a dollar in a year. It's going to be worth less because inflation. So basically each year inflation eats away at the value of that dollar.
Right. So to put it in kind of like layman's terms, it's kind of like, if you had a dollar 10 years ago, you could buy a loaf of bread.
Right.
But the inflation of bread now, you need $3 to buy a loaf of bread. So exactly. I can't do the same thing with the same dollar.
Exactly. Thank you very much. That's very true. So you definitely should have savings. You know, and really the goal, as they say, the goal really is to have about 6 months, or not more, 6 to 8 months of savings where you know that something happened, you lost your job, you fell down and broke your leg or something, that you could probably make it for 6 to 8 months. That's what you really should have.
You know what? That is amazing. When I read that, I was like, wow, I can't imagine. And that was like, when I first read that, I was like, okay, up the savings. Right.
Right.
And savings mean like just that emergency fund account. At first they used to suggest 3 months. Now it's like 6 months. And then I read something the other day that's realistically, it's like a year, because if you lose your job, it may be. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, that's really like, how many people, Black people in particular, if they lost their job, if they, you know, now we know the number one way that the number one reason that people apply for bankruptcy is for medical debt.
Yes.
Like if yes. you get cancer, if you have a life-threatening illness, if you get hospitalized, it can literally make you bankrupt. And yes. that's really scary because those are things you can't control.
Right. No, it's very true. And like I said, I have a daughter who has a very serious illness, and it was our first time experiencing and saying, wow, like, you know, medical, you know, issues, especially long-term or incurable diseases and things like that. It really does eat away at your state. We've, mm-hmm. you know, I can't tell you how much money we spend on medical expenses for mm-hmm. a daughter that has an incurable disease. So I think you're right. A lot of times it's not by people being lazy. It's really things like that. Right. These, you know, you get cancer or you different things like that. These medical, somebody, you know, different medical issues. And so it's really sad, and so that's obviously an issue to our, you know, our healthcare system.
Right.
But so yes, I think you definitely should have savings now. And I would say if you're starting off, because the reality is if you have $0 in savings, it's very mentally insurmountable to think about having 9 months of savings. You would say, I'm going to be saving for the next 50 years to get 9 months of savings, you know? So you have to really think about, I would say that my goal would be to say, get even like $2,000 in savings. Just get that. Just enough that you know that if something, my car broke down, you know, I need to get a transmission or something, a new tires, you know, mm-hmm. you can go to that. And then I think you get that emergency just stash that, you know, mm-hmm. you can go to very quickly for something that, you know, freak accident or something like that. So that's one, you know, level of your strategy. And then, you know, what you have in the bank. And then obviously I said I would not delay investing. You know, I would definitely make sure that my retirement account, if I work for someone, my retirement account is, I max out my company match. If I'm an entrepreneur, make sure you start a retirement account. That might be a solo 401k. But, you know, cause you have to be mindful of your own retirement because no one is doing that for you. Mm. So a lot of entrepreneurs, they might delay that. You know, they might say, I'm just so busy trying to invest in a business. I'll delay retirement until whenever. And the reality is you should really be thinking about your own retirement because, you know,
especially as an entrepreneur, nobody else is investing into your retirement.
Right. So that's a really, you know, that's really important to do that. And then, you know, and obviously I say take advantage of the stock market. You can do that. You know, it's very simple. Like I said, you can, you know, there's mutual funds, and these are mutual funds are where you know, it's basically like a basket of stocks that somebody's basically doing the thinking for you. That's a very easy way to have a slice of a lot of different companies. Or if you really want to, let's say, get your own brokerage account, there's a lot, you can do it online. That's like, there's a, you know, TD, what's it called? Scottrade. You can just, you know, sign up for an account and maybe I want to buy a share of Apple or something. I want to buy Disney. And I think anything you look at for your investments, you're really thinking about it as something that's higher risk, you know, so you know that you're going into it that is higher risk. But you're hoping to get higher return, you know, for that. And so, but you wouldn't put all your money there. You put some money there that you would be comfortable, you know, kind of letting it, you know, you'd be comfortable if something happened to it.
So we have just a couple more minutes left to the show. What are some of the kind of like key parting things that you want to leave the listeners with, that they action steps that they can take to start changing their wealth outcome?
Mm-hmm. So number one, so I would say, like, so I love, you know, we're in January. I would say that, let's say our assignments, where we're going to be going, leaving the studio today to do. Number one, I would say that check your credit score. Make sure you know your credit score. So this is the beginning of the year. Pull your credit score so you know exactly what creditors are seeing about you. To make sure there's no mistakes. You know, sometimes there's errors on your credit score. So really know kind of that. I would say number two, for the next month. So let's say February is a short month. Track your expenses. A lot of times we think we're spending $100, but we're really spending $200 or something. So really track your expenses and really be diligent. There's a lot of apps. I love my phone. You know, phones are great for calling, but they have a lot of financial apps on here. Mm. There's mint.com, which is a great app.
I have that.
Yes. So you can, you know, you have your phone with you. If you buy $2 coffee, you know, at Starbucks,
yep.
put it in. So you, and begin to know what you actually have.
Creditkarma.com is free credit scores, yes. free tracking.
Right.
I love that.
Yes. So definitely, I would say for the month, track your expenses and set a budget. Really. And I would say this too, you know, if you're working for 40 hours a week, make sure that you're taking a percentage of that and you're investing in it yourself. Don't just work 40 hours a week and every dollar you make is going to pay somebody else. Mm-hmm. Make sure that you say, if I'm working 40 hours a week, that I at least make sure that I've put myself first by saving, by, you know, having maybe if it's 10% of my money, or that I automatically know I'm saving it every single month of that. So that's another tip, is that any savings you have, make it automatic. Don't think about it. put it in your account to say each month at the first of the month, I'm taking $100 out of this and putting it towards savings. So those are some key steps you could do right now to get better track of your wealth.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me, Anna. We all have some to-do stuff when we finish with this show. Thank you so much. I want to thank you for listening and tuning in to Mornings with Mubaraka, which is your Wednesday morning voice every Wednesday on 103.5 FM in New Haven area. And I will log off today reminding you, as I do every week, be a voice and not an echo.